Drew Weston. Drew Weston received his BA at Harvard, his MA in Social and Political Thought at the University of Sussex, England, his PhD in Clinical Psychology at the University of Michigan. He is a guest blogger at the Huffington Post and on NPR's All Things Considered, the founder of Weston Strategies, a political corporate and consulting firm. And according to Howard Dean, chairman, Democratic Party, Drew Weston is a must-read and a must-hear for any Democrat. In 2008, we will win the presidency if our candidate reads and acts on this book. Welcome, Drew Weston.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Okay, and I have to mention that when your book first came out and I interviewed on Free Forum, I remember that I started out by telling you that I first heard of the book while I was traveling in Kenya and an op-ed talking about their upcoming election made the point that the candidates in Kenya ought to read your book. And that was sort of a real wake-up call to me that something was happening with the ideas you were putting forward.
You know, what's funny is that I've gotten the same response from leaders from all over the world. I thought I was describing, I mean, some of it, the main thesis of the book being that voters primarily vote with their emotions, that they don't, they don't add up all the policies and positions of the candidates and take the sum of one and compare it to the sum of the other and say, oh, this one's the rational choice. You know, that they do most of that with their gut and with their emotions, and they come to a global judgment. But that part I thought was probably universal. The part that I didn't realize was as universal as it seems to be is how the right and the left have differed on that for so many years, across many cultures, including non-Western democracies as well as Western ones.
And I mean, I would really think that would be interesting because you found yourself talking about the Democrats, the Republicans, this sort of thing, and then it turns out all over the world, similar breakdown.
Yeah, I started getting calls, from New Zealand and Australia and England, and then it started from Italy and even South Korea, where I would get into. And interesting that you said Kenya is that the same left-right difference, which we did not see this year very happily for some of us, which is that people on the left tend to think that if you just out argue the other side with ideas, then build it and they will come. And people on the right tend to think that you need to energize people with emotions. And in general, people on the right in that case are right, and on the left are wrong. But what's interesting is that seems to be the case cross-culturally.
Yeah, that I do find very interesting. And as you thought about that, or as you talked with people from other cultures, did you gain any kind of a new insight on why it seems to span cultures? I'll tell you, the first thought off the top of my head is, and this is a weird one, but it's that the progressive, the liberal, likes to think of the citizen as a thinking person, as someone who's cares about issues and is probably informed and that sort of thing. And perhaps the right figures, hey, they're ducks for us to line up and knock over. That's a slanted way of putting it. But what's your thought?
No, I think that's certainly a big piece of it. I mean, it's not an accident that the Enlightenment was, the people who brought us the Enlightenment and all of the founders of this country called themselves liberals. And, by liberals, they meant people who believed in tolerance, people who believed in thinking things out, people who believed in the power of reason, people who believed in science. So in that sense, it's not an accident that you would see that right-left distinction. I think you also see it in part because of there tends to be more of a reliance on faith and on black and white thinking on the right. You're either with us or you're against us, or a fetus either is a person or it's not a person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that tends just not to be how people on the left think.
Mm-hmm. And so once you've got it that you're either with us or against us, then your goal is to get them with you or energize them if they are. If there's more gray area, then you got to hope that you can persuade them and convince them and all that sort of thing. What I'd like to do is ask you basically two big questions. The big one is, what does the book say? And then how did it play out in this election?
Well, I couldn't actually have asked for a better case study of the book than this one, but it's nice in this case to be able to say I actually wrote the book in advance. the only way that I suppose it's cheating is that the participants in it had a chance to read the book. So, as a scientist, I'd say it's a contaminated experiment, but I'm glad it got contaminated.
Exactly.
Where the subjects aren't supposed to know what the study is about. But the basic thesis of the book is that in fact we are not even those of us on the left, we are not the rational creatures we think we are. That, I mean, realistically, there are many people who are probably listening to this who are in the Republican tax bracket, whose rational self-interest is to vote Republican, yet they consider themselves progressives and they voted for Barack Obama. In this case, I've had this conversation with many. I live in Georgia, and with many businessmen sitting up in business class of airplanes, where they'll say, "Well, explain to me how you can be for someone who'll raise your taxes." And I say, "Well, first of all, it depends on who you mean by you. When you say raise your taxes, but the second thing is that I don't know about you, but I've just lost 30% of my assets in the stock market because of this radical ideology of deregulation. I would be happy to get that 30% back and trade it in for a 3% tax increase. That'd be absolutely fine with me." But in general, the point of the book is that people vote with their gut. They vote with basically two questions in mind. One of them is, how do I feel about the values of this party and its principles? And the second is, what feelings do these candidates elicit from me? What gut level feelings do I have about these candidates? And the scientific evidence suggests that once you've answered those two questions, that predicts about 95% of people's votes.
95%.
Yeah, I mean the first 80% of votes come down to what do you feel when you see the D or the R by somebody's name?
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a huge percent, and much as those of us on the left would like to think that we're rational, my colleagues and I at Emory University did a study using brain scanning back in 2004 during the election of 2004 between Bush and Kerry, and we were studying what happened in the brain as people were presented with threatening information about their candidate in the form of a essentially a logical test. The candidate says A, then he says B. Are these things contradictory? And there was no question in any of them that they were all contradictory. Well, as much as a partisan, I would have liked to find the Fox News circuits of the brain that distort reality. It turned out the Democrats and Republicans looked exactly alike. That for that 80%, 85% maybe, who are really firmly committed one way or another, as soon as the data don't fit what they want to believe, they simply change the data in their mind. And then if that doesn't work, they'll just keep shifting the goalposts, just as, the reasons for the war in Iraq changed from, weapons of mass destruction to spreading freedom. And when it wasn't really spreading freedom, it became, it just the goalposts kept moving.
Right, right. I also noticed that although the biggest gist of the book is this point, that it's about feelings, it's about emotions, it's about that sort of thing, and rational will lose, facts will lose to emotions and so on. But you also talk about story, and in your column about Obama's victory on the 17th of November, you said, in the closing 8 weeks of the campaign, Obama controlled the four stories that matter most in an election: the story you tell about yourself, the story you tell about your opponent, the story the other candidate is telling about himself, and the stories that the other candidate is telling about you. Tell me how this thing of emotion and stories fit together.
It's a really good question, and the book does have about 15 long chapters. So I shouldn't say long. My editor cut me, but it does have about 15 chapters to get into a lot more nuance than just it's the emotion stupid, which is sort of the pithy description of what this is about. But you're right, stories are crucial to it, and in part, if you think about just our evolutionary heritage, human beings existed about 100,000 years before the development of the first written language. And that means that somehow we had to transmit our values and our knowledge, including in particular our knowledge about what's good for us and bad for us and good for our families and bad for our families and the people who matter to us, which back then was tribe and clans and now is families and groups ranging all the way up through nation states and human beings and sentient creatures, or depending on who you are. But for about 100,000 years, the only way we had to convey those, the moral of the story, essentially, was through storytelling. And our brains are essentially wired to expect a certain structure to stories. And what made Ronald Reagan such a good politician was that he never gave people laundry lists of, here's my 12-point plan. Bill Clinton was the same way. He never gave laundry lists like that. If you compare that to Hillary Clinton, and eventually to Barack Obama, you see why Bill Clinton and Barack Obama both beat their primary and their general election candidates, is because they told a story, or they told a series of stories, rather than just saying, let me tell you about my 10-12-point plans, which is the standard Democratic way of trying to win, which virtually always loses.
Let me cut in quickly to say that, yet, as I think everyone would say, they're two of the more intelligent, more policy wonk candidates we've ever had, yet they were smart enough not to let their smarts get in their way.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think what both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama share that is really very different from most politicians, because Hillary Clinton certainly has what psychologists call general intelligence, or the G factor. I mean, she has a lot more of it, I suspect, than I have. But what Bill Clinton and Barack Obama share is they both have both general intelligence, really high general intelligence, and really high emotional intelligence. You know, that ability to zero in on what people feel, and Bill Clinton was remarkable at that in town hall settings, and Barack Obama got better and better at it. But in his capacity, for both of them, you saw a phenomenal capacity to inspire. And what we're seeing at the same time with Barack Obama now is also a real capacity to think things out that's not what gets you elected, but it is what allows you to govern well.
Right. So let me just ask basically probably one last question, depending on how long it takes you. What do we see that's the same or different since the election in the way that Obama is presenting himself, rolling out his team, that sort of thing?
I think a couple of things. One is that it took Barack Obama a long time to put together the whole package in a funny sort of way. And that, in the last 8 weeks of the election, he did have all four of those stories about himself, about McCain. He finally told a story about McCain, and starting in early to mid September. Before then, he kind of left it up to McCain to define himself, and you never want to do that in an election, because then the other guy defines himself as he wants, and he defines you as he wants, and then you're in trouble.
And that was Rove's probably greatest skill.
Absolutely. Yeah. He always defined his opponent the second that opponent the second it became clear that that was going to be his opponent.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing with Barack Obama now, though, is the same thing that we saw through the financial crisis, which, people say that it's the economy that made the difference in this election, and surely it was the biggest factor in the election, that the toppling of the financial markets that affected everybody, 6% heading into 7% unemployment, all that stuff played a huge impact. But one of the things that really convinced people was Barack Obama's steadiness through all of that, his absolutely unbelievable sort of confident steadfastness and calm in the face of what, frankly, would make most normal human beings incredibly anxious privately, let alone publicly. And what we're seeing now, I think, is that is exactly the same thing as he rolls out these positions of people who are going to be in his cabinet and beyond. We're seeing the same kind of just steadiness and I'm not worried, you needn't worry either kind of attitude that is extremely comforting for people in times that are as anxiety provoking as these.
Very good. Let me finally say that when Barack Obama first began to surface as a potential candidate, I said to people who at that point it looked like Hillary was going to be the Democratic nominee or had the inside track, that why I didn't want her to be and why I hoped he or perhaps Edwards was, that when America is ready for change, they like optimistic and charismatic candidates.
And you were absolutely right. That was, you know, my biggest worry, frankly, as a Democrat about Hillary Clinton was that she didn't convey either the optimism or the charisma that Barack Obama and to some extent John Edwards also had. And it was clear from the moment Barack Obama spoke in 2004 at the convention.
That's right. And when I go back FDR, Reagan, Clinton. I mean, it doesn't matter the policies. There's something. America, if they're going to change, they want to put their hopes in a charismatic optimist. And now we shall see how that plays out. Drew Westland, I really want to thank you for being with us. And I'd love to check in with you, you know, now and again as we see how this continues to play out. What do things look like in Georgia tomorrow?
It all comes down to turnout. If the Obama team mobilizes the way it mobilized on Election Day, we may well have a Democrat elected. And if not, we'll get another Republican.
Okay, thank you very much. I've been speaking with Drew Westland. The book is The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. You've got a couple of websites. If people want to learn more about you, where would you tell them to go?
They could go either to westonstrategies.com, it's Weston with an E-N, or they could go to my Emory University website.
Okay, and you just go to Emory and track down Drew Westland. Thank you very much, Drew Westland.